From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with journalist Nicholas Daniloff. In the fall of 1986, Daniloff found himself at the center of U.S.-Soviet tensions when he was arrested by the KGB and charged with espionage. Also today, I speak with French-Canadian filmmaker Jean-Claude Lauzon. He just swept the Canadian Oscars with his first feature film Night Zoo, a thriller about the criminal underclass in Montreal. Dr. John's back at our piano for our weekly performance spot. Today he pays tribute to Hoagy Carmichael. And critic Ken Tucker reviews the new home video versions of the classic Sherlock Holmes movies starring Basil Rathbone as the world's greatest detective. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. In the fall of 1986, Nicholas Daniloff spent 13 days in a Soviet prison on charges of spying. At the time, he was the Moscow correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. He was arrested after one of his acquaintances gave him an envelope, which turned out to contain photographs of what the Soviet authorities said were military facilities. It was widely believed that Daniloff was set up to give the Soviets a bargaining chip in the release of Gennady Zakharov, a Soviet who had been arrested a few days earlier in America on charges of spying. After negotiations between Soviet and American officials, the Soviets released Daniloff and dissident Yuri Orlov, and the U.S. released Zakharov. Since Daniloff's return to the United States, he's immersed himself in writing about the Soviet Union. He just finished the manuscript for a new book titled Two Lives, One Russia. It's about his own experiences and those of his great-great-grandfather, who was exiled to Siberia in 1827 under Tsar Nicholas I. Daniloff is now a contributing editor to U.S. News and World Report and is a resident fellow at the Center for Press and Politics at Harvard University. Nicholas Daniloff, welcome to Fresh Air.
How are you? Nice to be here.
Since you were imprisoned and then forced to leave the Soviet Union, did you get more obsessed with the Soviet Union?
No, I wouldn't say I became more obsessed with the Soviet Union. I was always interested in that country for a variety of different reasons. One was the family background. Another was it's a very interesting topic for anybody who wants to be a diplomatic correspondent.
You're comparing your life and your imprisonment with that of your great-great-grandfather. What are some of the similarities between the circumstances both of you found yourselves under?
Well, I think the similarity was possibly in the way that we were treated once we were arrested. In his case, he was held in solitary confinement in the Peter Paul Fortress in St. Petersburg. And he was judged to be guilty, essentially, without any kind of a trial. In my case, I was held in a prison in Moscow, and I was judged to be guilty by the Soviets because they really needed to have a hostage to bargain their man back to the Soviet Union. There was no trial in my case. There was a charade of a trial in my great-great-grandfather's case.
You know, there's an ironic parallel, and that is that your grandfather was exiled to Siberia under the Tsar, and you were imprisoned under the communist authorities, you know, whose revolution overthrew the Tsar. But you both, ended up in prison.
Well, there are more similarities than that. You know, one of the very strange things is that all of the, I shouldn't really say Daniloff's, because my ancestor was on the maternal side, and his name was Frolov. But all of us who come down through this line have a very particular kind of nose that has a hump in it. And when my ancestor was imprisoned, a physical description of him was written in St. Petersburg in the prison, and that was in 1826. And that physical description said that he had a large nose with a hump. And when my physical description was being taken in prison in Moscow, the guards started noting down all of these characteristics, and they sounded strangely familiar to me. And I took off my glasses, and I said, well, what would you say about my nose? And the guard looked at it very matter-of-factly and said, well, it's a large nose with a hump. In actuality, exactly the same description. So that was a very unnerving similarity.
Journalist Nicholas Daniloff is my guest. You had first covered the Soviet Union in the 1960s. You returned in the 80s. How had the conditions for journalists, American journalists, changed?
Well, even in the early 1980s, the Soviet Union was a very much more open place than it was in the early 60s. In the early 60s, it really was still pretty well buttoned down and closed, and it was very difficult even to meet Soviet citizens and have any kind of sensible conversation with them. 20 years later, during the dying years of Leonid Brezhnev, the place was much more open, I think, because the Soviets had made a decision that they had to trade with Western Europe if they were going to keep going and maintain a reasonable standard of living. That forced them to open up the middle-level bureaucracy to businessmen, and I think journalists got sort of a fringe benefit from that. And we found in the early 80s, 81, 82, 83, that it was much more possible to talk to Soviet officials. There were some press conferences that were going on. It was possible to travel around the Soviet Union in a way that hadn't been possible 20 years before. So today, when we look at Gorbachev's Russia and we see the policy of glasnost and so forth, it is not all that strange because the prelude to that already had been set.
So the second round of your visits to the Soviet Union, you had more contact with people who live there. Did you feel that you were more likely to be set up because of those contacts? Were you more vigilant about the friends that you made and the acquaintances that you spoke
to? Well, I don't think so, you know, but I would say that the possibility of being set up had increased in that sense, that one had more contacts. And, you know, if you don't want to be set up, you can remain in your office. You can never open your mail because a secret document might come in the mail. You can never call anybody. You can stay there and never go out and never meet anybody.
You think the authorities would maybe like that?
And authorities rather would like that, of course, because then you would be a much more timid number, so to speak. Any journalist who is worth his salt, it seems to me, has to take certain risks, has to go out, has to reach out. And in so doing, you open a vulnerable side. You do it consciously. I did it consciously. Insofar as this gentleman by the name of Misha is concerned, it was really a confidence game. He gained my confidence over a period of years. It wasn't that I had just met him or anything of that sort. I had known him for 3 or 4 years. We had met every year once, maybe twice. He had ingratiated himself by giving me and my wife presents. He seemed to be a reasonable, pleasant, straightforward sort of person. We did ask ourselves on a number of occasions whether he could be a KGB plant or something of that sort, but he didn't really seem the type.
Why not? What about him did not fit the type?
What didn't fit was that he seemed to be rather insecure. He seemed to be not overly aggressive. He did not seem to have an incredible sense of confidence, which are the sorts of qualities that you often find in KGB operatives who are dealing or having relations with foreign correspondents.
Now, how did he set you up with the envelope?
Well, what happened was after Zakharov had been arrested in New York, and remember, he was a Soviet operative without diplomatic immunity, meaning that he was going to stand trial and get a heavy prison sentence.
Yeah, he had worked at the UN as a physicist.
The KGB clearly was concerned about this, and they did not want him to be sentenced by an American court and have to serve a long prison term in the United States. So they decided to make a retaliatory arrest, something, by the way, that they have done on 4 previous occasions over the last 25 years. This is not, by any case, the first instance. And as I say, about a week after, but very shortly after Zakharov was arrested in New York, I got a phone call from Misha saying that he'd like to meet me. And actually, I wanted to meet him because he had asked me to get some Stephen King novels for him in the United States. And these had been kicking around my apartment for nearly a year. I hadn't seen him in that long. And I was just about to leave the Soviet Union. It was the end of my assignment. I had 1 week more to go. I wanted to get those books out of my apartment and get them to Misha, who they were really destined for. So it seemed perfectly straightforward and innocent. And I met him by prearrangement. Actually, he at first wanted to meet me at night. I refused to do that because it didn't seem to me that I wanted to go out at night to meet Misha on some street corner. We decided to meet in the open at a metro station, and we went for a walk along the river. It was a lovely Saturday fall day, and we had done this walk before, so there was nothing unusual in that. And I gave him these books, and he said, "Now I have a present for you," and handed me this package.
Were you supposed to give it to someone? Was it just for
you? Oh, no, the package was contained clippings from local newspapers. I had asked him at one point if he could help me understand how Mr. Gorbachev's policies were being implemented in the town of Frunze. And would he give me some clippings, get me some clippings, which I couldn't get in Moscow? As a matter of fact, I asked 5 or 6 different people to do this for me. Misha turned out to be the only bad apple in all of this. And when he gave me this package, it turned out there weren't just clippings from the local newspaper. There were these secret photographs. Incidentally, I did not open the package. I intended to walk home. And when I got home, I was going to take a look at the package.
Is there a mental checklist that you used to walk around with of what things should I maybe check out before accepting a package from anyone?
No, I don't think so. And, you know, I would say that foreign correspondents in Moscow, Americans in particular, are accepting packages all the time from Soviet citizens. If you think you have a friend and there's a relationship there, there's an element of trust, there's nothing at all unusual about that. And I'm told, incidentally, that after the incident, my colleagues in Moscow were a little bit more cautious about who they met, where they met, and what they accepted from these people. But that caution disappeared after about 3 months. And one friend said to me, you know, and after about 3 months, I started accepting packages all over again.
So you accepted this package. You were walking away from your meeting with him.
Yeah,
with
that's
this
right.
Package. And
that's
when
right.
were you arrested?
Well, Misha at one point said that he had to leave, and I said I'd walk to the subway with him. And he began getting very jittery and saying, no, it's too far and there's not enough time. And he wanted to get away, obviously, and he did. And then I started walking home. And as I was walking out of the park, these two cars came down in my direction. And one of these cars went off in the direction that Misha had taken, and I assume picked Misha up, having done a good job, and took him back to wherever they took him. And the other car was actually a small minivan, and 8 guys jumped out of it and jumped all over me and put handcuffs on me.
Did you know what was going on?
I guessed, but they sure didn't explain. I mean, they didn't say who they were. They didn't pull out their IDs and say, look, we're from the KGB and we're arresting you. They didn't wave an arrest warrant in my face. They didn't have an arrest warrant. They didn't get the arrest warrant until 3 days after the action. So, I mean, what you got to imagine is a guy peacefully walking home, and all of a sudden, 8 characters appear on the street and jump him and put him in handcuffs, throw him in a van, take him off to the prison. That's a very frightening experience.
I'll bet it is. Now, you've described how the photographs that were in this package were laid out and how you were photographed in front of this layout of the photographs. and you stuck up your forefinger in that
symbol
that we all know,
American,
right?
gesture.
As a way to indicate to anyone seeing this photograph that you were not responsible for this. Now, did anyone see it and interpret it the way you wanted
well,
it
that,
to?
Well, that photograph was never made public.
Uh-huh. Because of your finger?
I have no idea.
Maybe
why
your
it was
finger
never...
stopped it. Maybe
it may well be that the finger stopped it. I mean, I got the idea of doing that from the incident with the USS Pueblo off of North Korea at the end of the 1960s. I mean, that's so far away, everybody probably has forgotten it. But when those sailors were captured by the North Koreans, they made similar gestures in the photographs that were taken of them. And I didn't know when I was taken to the prison when I ever would be in contact with the Western world again. And so I saw this opportunity, and I had the wit to think, well, I'll just give them this nice little American gesture. And if the photograph is published, then somebody out there will understand what it was all about.
Journalist Nicholas Daniloff is my guest. Now, you were interrogated for 3-hour sessions for days. And as you've pointed out, you had no military training, you had no background in imprisonment or interrogation, so you really weren't prepared for these kinds of sessions. What kind of rules did you create for yourself about which types of questions to answer and which not to answer and what kinds of answers to give?
Well, you know, it's a very good point you make. I had to decide on the spot how I was going to handle the situation. And, you know, that's no way to make that kind of decision. You really need to think about it more and have some preparation. At the beginning of these sessions, the interrogator read me my rights. But in so doing, he omitted to read me my most important rights, or at least the rights that were the most important to me.
Which were?
And those were Article 46 of the Criminal Code, which allows you not to answer any questions. It's sort of the equivalent of the Fifth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is Article 142, which provides an opportunity or gives you the possibility of not signing any documents. So I was caught in this bind, first of all, of not knowing that there were these rights available to me, and secondly, the interrogator giving me every kind of indication that I had to answer his questions totally, and that I had to sign papers, you know, stating what it was that I had stated to him. And in the end, I did that. Of course, I look back on this, and I have certain second thoughts about all of that. But in any event, getting back to the interrogation, I would say that I was interrogated in a rather mild manner, in the sense that I was only interrogated 3 or 4 hours a day. I was not interrogated in the middle of the night, for example, as other people have been. I mean, people have been interrogated for 15, 24 hours at a time. That did not happen. On the other hand, it is not totally truthful to say that I was well treated, because I was subjected to what I think can be described as mild physical torture. And that mild torture consisted of the following, and you'd be the judge whether it's torture or not. The light is never turned off in your cell, and that makes it difficult to sleep at night. Secondly, I was put on a diet very low in calories. I needed 2,200 calories a day. I got about 1,200 a day. That meant that I weakened physically, and I lost quite a lot of weight. My belt was taken away from me immediately. My watch was taken away from me immediately. My shoelaces were taken away from me immediately. I was not allowed to wash except once a week, and I was allowed to shave twice a week. Now, the combination of all of that is a combination designed to weaken you. And that's why I call that mild physical torture. It was bearable, but its aim was to weaken you. And the interrogation itself was all intended to incriminate you in every conceivable way.
Well, what did you do to counteract the weakening effect that these other conditions had?
Well, you know, it was very tough. It was very tough. I was helped to the extent that I had several meetings with my wife during this period. She reported to me all of the support that was being generated in the United States, both at the popular level and at the very highest government level. And, of course, that was a very great aid.
So what kind of questions were you asked, and which did you and didn't you answer?
Well, you know, I was asked all sorts of questions about Misha. And my relationship with him. But beyond being asked questions about him, where I met him, why we met, you know, and that sort of thing, the interrogator kept pressing me to acknowledge or to admit to things that I hadn't done. And one of the things that he wanted me to admit to was that, one, that I was an espionage agent. Two, that I collected information on instructions of the CIA. And three, that whatever information I got, I took to the CIA. And he kept bullying me on these points. And he said, now admit it. And I refused.
Was there an incentive given to you, if you admit this, then you're free, or if you admit this,
well,
then the interrogation stops?
It was never quite that clear. But when they did come out with the indictment, what they said was, espionage is a very serious crime, and we punish it with long prison terms right up to the death sentence. And they let that sink in a little bit about the death sentence. And then, of course, the corollary to all of that was, answer truthfully and things will go better for you than if you don't answer truthfully.
And did you take that to heart? I mean, what?
Well, I mean, I was happy to answer truthfully because it was all tommy rot. I mean, it wasn't true.
But you knew what they wanted to hear, though.
I knew what they wanted to hear. And of course, what is so awful is that when a lie is being forced upon you, it's easy to counter by saying the truth. And you feel good about it because you know, I am telling the truth. It's not true. But the truth doesn't always counter a lie. And that is what is so distressing, that the truth doesn't always counter a lie.
My guest is journalist Nicholas Daniloff. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. Nicholas Daniloff was arrested on spying charges in the fall of 1986. And as you'll recall, he was released at the same time that Gennady Zakharov, a spy who was arrested in America, was released. And Daniloff was the Moscow correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. He's now a fellow at Harvard University and has just written a book, which will be published sometime in the near future. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Nicholas Daniloff is my guest. When you were in the prison, did you know about the possible arrangements that were being made to release you and Zakharov at the same time?
Well, no, you know, nobody really knew what the state of negotiations were. But I had some thoughts on that subject while I was in prison, and I communicated those thoughts through my wife to the U.S. Embassy, and they were relayed back to the White House and went straight to the President of the United States. And oddly enough, my formula was the formula that prevailed in the first step. That is, there were two steps, you know, the release into custody and then the second arrangement whereby the Soviets gave up Yuri Orlov, released me, the Americans put Zakharov on trial and found him guilty for espionage.
Now, did you feel that, well, at least something really good came out of this Yuri Orlov got released as part of the deal?
You know, the Russians have a lot of folk wisdom, and one of their sayings is that there's always something good that comes out of bad. And, I mean, it's the same as there's always a silver lining in a cloud or something of that sort. I think a lot of good actually came out of the affair in the end. Part of that good was the release of Yuri Orlov. Part of that good was that I was released and the charges against me were dropped and the case was closed. Part of that good was that Mr. Shevardnadze, the Soviet foreign minister, and George Shultz, the American Secretary of State, spent something like 13 hours or 18 hours face-to-face discussing my case. And I think out of that, they came to a better understanding one of the other. And I think that has led to better communications at that level in the Soviet-American dialogue. And the final bit of good that came out of it, in my view, is that there was a mini-summit conference in Iceland. And even though that summit conference was very controversial, and President Reagan may have said certain things that perhaps on reflection he ought not to have said at that time, if you look at the history since the Reykjavik summit, things have been going in the right direction in our relations with the Soviet Union. So for that, I am grateful. I think that's good.
You've had plenty of time to say, why did they pick on me? So what kind of answers have you come up with on that?
Well, you know, first of all, Zakharov was arrested. They needed to have a victim in Moscow, a hostage. In the past, they had chosen a professor and a businessman on several other occasions. I think in this case, they eliminated the businessman option because they wanted to court foreign capital and get overseas investors to come in and help them build up the Soviet economy. So businessman was out. I think they were not interested in professors, possibly because all the professors had gone home. It was the end of the summer, and they were going back to the academic year in America. So you come to journalists. Now, journalists are very attractive because they collect information. That's what spies do. Spies send their information to intelligence agencies with intent to harm. Journalists collect information for the benefit of their readers with intent to enlighten. But they send information. And they're out collecting it. So I think a journalist seemed attractive on that basis. Now, which journalist? And I think there were probably two candidates there. One was the correspondent who worked for the New York Times, and the other was myself. But the other fellow had a great advantage over me in that he was not there when they needed him. He'd gone to South Africa to look over his coming assignment.
Was it Serge Neiman?
That was Serge Neiman, yeah. He didn't, in the end, didn't go to South Africa, but that's another story. But the point is, he wasn't there when they needed him, and I was, so I became the victim.
I think it's easy to become more wary of people and more paranoid after a situation like this. Do you feel that you've been afflicted with greater paranoia after you were arrested?
No, I really don't feel I've been afflicted by more paranoia. I think that working in Moscow is an assignment where paranoia is built into the picture. You're always looking over your shoulder to see who's reporting on you, who's spying on you, who's setting you up. And, you know, that's not a pleasant way to live, and it's not a normal way to live. And fortunately, I think, my wife and I and my family did not live that way in Moscow. We said to hell with all this paranoia. We sent our son to a Soviet school, for example. We wanted him to learn Russian, and he went to a Soviet school. We had enormous numbers of Soviet friends. We lived not in a diplomatic ghetto. That was sort of a fluke of history that we don't necessarily have to get into. But we were not guarded by policemen, as most foreigners are. So it meant that Russians could come to our apartment all the time. And I've got to tell you that I have very warm and friendly feelings to all of those wonderful friends I've had in Moscow. And I have no hard feelings about them. Where I do have hard feelings is with the KGB. There, I think you're dealing with a very large, very well-developed police apparatus, which is essentially repressive and divisive of Soviet society.
I always find it interesting when a journalist becomes the subject of press coverage, like you did when you were released and for a long time afterwards, and still, such as this interview. But do you feel like you learned more about journalism in America by being the subject of the coverage? Any revelations from that for you?
I don't think so. I mean, after all, I'd been on the other side of the barricades for 30 years. I knew what journalists did. And, of course...
how do you mean that?
Well, I mean, I understand how intrusive journalists are, uh-huh. and I don't hold it against them. What happens when attention becomes focused on people in this kind of situation is that you get more attention than you want, and it comes at times when you do not want it. But I've always had kindly feelings towards my colleagues, and particularly as a result of this situation, because they kept the issue alive. They made it a number one, page one story for 1 month, and they made it so the President of the United States and the leader of the Soviet Union could not continue business as usual until this case was resolved. So I've got a great debt to the American press, and I must say, if I may just add this little note, having visited Independence Hall this afternoon, in prison I thought a lot about the American Constitution, and two things struck me as being highly important that had not really quite struck me this way before. One is the freedom of the press, and two is the independence of the judicial process mm-hmm. from the executive in this country, meaning that the executive cannot manipulate a judicial proceeding and have it come out the way it wants it to come out. Those are two terribly valuable attributes of life in America. And, you know, I think about that and I am awed by it.
Well, thank you very much for sharing some of your thoughts and your experiences with us. Thank you for being here. My guest has been journalist Nicholas Daniloff, and he's now a contributing editor to U.S. News & World Report. He has a forthcoming book that you might be interested in. It's called Two Lives, One Russia. It will be published by Houghton Mifflin, and it will compare his experiences in the Soviet Union to those of his great-great-grandfather who was exiled under Tsar Nicholas. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'll be on vacation the next 2 weeks, and the Peabody Award-winning radio interviewer Faith Middleton will be here. You may have heard her pieces on Morning Edition and Weekend Edition. She also hosts a popular show on Connecticut Public Radio called Open Air. Her guest on the next program will be Leon Fleischer, the celebrated pianist and conductor. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Rarely does a first feature film hit viewers the way the Canadian film Night Zoo did. It just won 13 Genies, the Canadian version of the Oscar, and shocked some critics with its portrayals of Montreal's criminal underclass. Coming up, we talk with Jean-Claude Lauzon, a former member of that underclass and the man who made Night Zoo. Also, Mac Rebenack, better known as Dr. John, pays tribute to Hoagy Carmichael in our weekly performance spot. And with the home video release of the classic Sherlock Holmes movies starring Basil Rathbone, the game can be afoot right in your own living room. Ken Tucker has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. Robert Dole today conceded he has little chance of catching George Bush in the race for the Republican presidential nomination. His comments touched off a flurry of speculation about when the Dole campaign will end. NPR's Jim Angle has details.
Dole aides deny the senator has made any decision about withdrawing, but they concede, as one put it, there is a day-by-day reassessment of the campaign. The Dole campaign has been plagued by rumors of withdrawal lately. Those rumors got a boost today from the senator himself.
I think it's probably pretty much a foregone conclusion what's happening on the Republican side. But I still have some things to say.
Dole was asked if his remarks were a statement of withdrawal. He said, "I may have something to say about that this week, probably next week." But at the moment, aides say the senator still plans to go on to the Wisconsin primary April 5th. One aide, asked to explain Dole's remarks today, said he signaled what is fairly obvious. Bush has just about got it wrapped up. The significance of Dole's comments today seemed to be that the senator is now focusing on what everyone else has been telling him, that George Bush's nomination is all but inevitable. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
President Reagan said today that he still believes Oliver North is a hero, and Mr. Reagan predicted that North and former National Security Advisor John Poindexter will be found innocent of charges stemming from their involvement in the Iran-Contra affair. More from NPR's Brian Naylor.
The president's comments came at the end of a question-and-answer session with some college students when he was asked if he still believes that Oliver North is a hero. The student also asked if the president would pardon North and John Poindexter, the former National Security Advisor. Both men have been indicted by a federal grand jury for their roles in the Iran-Contra affair. Here's how the president responded.
I still think Ollie North is a hero. And at the other hand, in any talk about what I might do or pardons and so forth, I think with the case before the courts, that's something I can't discuss now. I just have to believe that they're going to be found innocent because I don't think they were guilty of any lawbreaking or any crime.
Asked afterwards about the propriety of the president's comments on a case yet to be heard in court, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said Mr. Reagan is, quote, a man who tells you what he thinks, and that's what he thinks. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
The Senate today voted unanimously to urge President Reagan to increase U.S. pressure against the military regime of Panamanian General Manuel Noriega. The non-binding resolution also calls on the White House to consider an economic assistance package to help a Democratic government replace the Noriega regime and rebuild Panama's economy. President Reagan was asked by reporters today whether he thinks the Dominican Republic would be a suitable place for Noriega to go into exile. No, the president said, it's not far enough. In Panama, the government was unable to pay its 15,000 troop army today because of a critical cash shortage, and the economy remained stalled in the fifth day of a general strike. Home sales rose 3.8% last month. The National Association of Realtors said today the increase in the sales of existing single-family homes was the first in 4 months. Lower interest rates and renewed consumer confidence are credited for much of the increase. Association spokesman Walt Maloney says the trend is likely to continue.
We're anticipating that with the present low level of interest rates that sales are going to pick up in the months ahead and then probably ease off. Yearly total should be pretty close to present levels.
The average home price rose in February to $88,300, up more than 3% from a year earlier. Another big drop on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 45 points to close the week at 1978.95. Declines led advances on volume of 163 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 53 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today we have some more tunes from our performer-in-residence, Mac Rebenack. He has many musical identities. In the 60s, he became known as Dr. John the Night Tripper. The band he led combined acid rock, New Orleans rhythms, and voodoo chanting. These days, he's also known for his New Orleans piano style, and he's a wonderful interpreter of standards. For today's performance piece, we asked Mac Rebenack to share a couple of tunes by one of his favorite composers, Hoagy Carmichael.
I always think of Hoagy Carmichael. I remember him from some flick in a deep, dark past on the television, singing Memphis in June and stuff like this. He was always a hip kind of barroom piano player, and I like to decompose a couple of Hoagy's tunes for you right now, starting with an old tune called Up the Lazy River. Up the Lazy River and a million real stream, lazy, lazy river, where we can sit and dream, linger in the shade of a kind old tree, throw away your troubles and dream a dream with me. And up the lazy river by the old mill run, lazy, lazy river in the noonday sun, skies up above, and everyone's in love. Up the lazy river with me. Whoa, the lazy river with me. Now up the lazy river by the old mill stream, that lazy, lazy river where we could just sit and dream, linger in the shade of a kind old tree, throw away your troubles, boy, and dream a dream with me. Up the lazy river by the old mill run, that lazy, lazy river in the noonday sun, let blue skies up above and everyone's in love. Up the lazy river, how happy we could be. The lazy river with me. Yeah, 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 yeah.
That's a old Hoagy tune I used to really dig. I used to play with various Dixieland bands, and now they do one, The Nearness of You. Starting out with a little, it's not the pale moon that excites me. Baby, that thrill and delights me. Oh, no, it's just a nearness of love in you. It's not your sweet conversation. Baby, that stirs up my imagination. It's you, child, and the nearness of love in you. When you're in my arms and I feel you so close to me, all my wildest dreams, baby, come true. And you know, sure enough, they do. It's not your sweet conversation, baby, that stirs up my imagination. It's you, child. And just a nearness of love for you. Thank you. close to me. All my wildest dreams, baby, come true. And you know damn well they do it. It's not your sweet conversation, baby, that stirs up my imagination. It's you, child, and the deepness of love. And all the stars above, and the needness of love.
Little Hoagie Carmichael stuff for you. Some oldies, but some real trueies and sweethearts of tunes you can't get away from.
Next week, Mac Rebennack pays tribute to one of his New Orleans inspirations, Louis Armstrong. This is Fresh Air.
You know, you can't be born in the bourgeoisie and write this kind of movie. I've been really close from this character. And I think in the film, I don't pass judgment on the people. I just look at them and I use them as a painter. I just look around me and I paint like people have been doing before.
Jean-Claude Lauzon paints with a film camera. His first film is a French-Canadian thriller called Night Zoo, and it has hit Canada with a jolt. In the beginning of Night Zoo, shortly before the main character is released from prison, he is raped. He subsequently rapes his girlfriend. The film travels through the subterranean depths of Montreal in fits of violence, rage, and revenge. It's a world that Jean-Claude Lauzon knows intimately. Night Zoo has just won 13 Genie Awards. That's the Canadian Oscar. One reviewer called it probably the most assured, sophisticated first film ever produced in Canada, and certainly the most amoral.
I think for sure this is, may look like a rough film compared to the American movie, but when you look at lots of European film, it's not that, you know, that violent or that... What is really funny is because when we were at Cannes Festival, lots of people were talking about the violence in the film, and compared to, you know, Chuck Norris movie and stuff like that, when you start a movie with, it's not the plastic blood. The problem with my film for some people is because they believe the character. And well, they believe there's some more violence than what they are in the film because they truly believe in the character.
Your new movie is a French-Canadian film. Are there certain hazards in making a film in French from Canada? I mean, do you get much distribution with a French-Canadian film?
For sure, if I was born in New York, it would be totally, totally different. An English film, when you start with a French-Canadian film, when you have to understand that even French people don't understand our language, we have to go French subtitle in France.
I mean, if you sent a French-Canadian film to France, it would have to be subtitled because the dialects are different?
Yeah, sure.
Is there a separate French film industry in Canada?
Yes, I mean, I think there's two separate, really totally different culture with totally different approach. One of the problem with the, and it's not really a problem, it's a reality, with the most talent young English director is as soon as they do have talent because they can express themselves in English really well, they just jump on the border and they don't have an history, a big background of strong director who have been staying in English-Canadian side. Norman Jewison is one of the only people who have been back. and try to help really strongly the Canadian industry cinema. But as a French Canadian, even if I want to jump on the other side, it's I have to run faster, and you know my film, you know, lots of Canadian English film I saw by American people, but French Canadian film, they don't look at it. You know, it's too much work, and it's harder for us to cross the border.
So in that respect, the French Canadian film industry has perhaps grown stronger than the English speaking Canadian film industry.
I mean, it's not a question of choice. It's not because we're so pure. It's just because we have to stay there and keep going in this kind of film. There were some time, I have to admit, there were some time when really strong director like Jutras and this kind of people, it was a statement to say we're going to do it in French, in French, Canadian French. It was a statement at the time.
So do you want to make English-speaking films in America? Is that an ambition of yours, if you're accepted?
No, it's not. I'm not waiting to be accepted. I'm not waiting to... it's not really an ambition of us. I'm sure if I did have the if I do have the chance to shoot in France, or in France, Paris, or shoot in New York, I would prefer to shoot in New York because I do feel close. If you look at the film, I do feel really close to be influenced by American cinema than European film. But it's not really an objective for me. The main objective right now is to take the time to go back on my feet and find a reason to make another film. When I did Un Sous la Nuit, I was having a reason. And if I can put my hand on a good script, you know, I will be really pleased to make a conversation or a film like A Taxi Driver. But I've been really influenced by lots of your great director here.
You were briefly in reform school. How did you wind up there?
Stealing purse, stealing car, chasing people around with baseball bat, and you know, like everybody do from when you're born in this kind of place, and you want to have fun.
Now, I read about you that it was in reform school that you were first introduced to filmmaking. Is that right?
No, that's not true. What did happen? It's I was going out, and I with the people I was talking about, the underground people who was making bang and stuff like that, and I was about 16, 17, and these people were really taking really well care of me, and they teach me how to drive a car, how to steal one, and I was going out with these people often, and what did happen, I was writing at the same time. I've been writing since I was really, really young, and somebody picked up something that I wrote. He was from National Film Board. His name was Andrei Petrovsky. And he did read it, something that I wrote, and started to look for me in Montreal for about 1 year and a half or 1 year. And he didn't find me. He gave me an appointment at the National Film Board. And I was blue collar at the time. I was working as a labor man. And he invited me to meet him at National Film Board. And I thought he was gay because most of the adults at the time who did take care of me were gay. And what did happen when I met him... he say you wrote that, and I say yes. He say in 15 years you're going to be really well known, or you're going to be in psychiatrist hospital. And he say I want you to go back to school, and I say I don't want to go back to school. And say you are a filmmaker, you don't know that, but you have to make movie. And I say I don't want to make movie, and I didn't know why this guy invite me. And he invite me home, at his home, and I meet their artists and painter and lots of people who influence the French culture. And introduced me to these people, but the only thing I did have on my mind at the time it was to rob his house. I find him so idiot to love me that I say, if I can have the key to come to this place and steal everything was there, because he was quite rich. And he started to kick my ass around to send me back to school. And I was keeping working as a labor man, but except the quality of the people around me changed because of this man, because he invited me to see, to look at theater, to go at National Film Board, looking at film, gave me lots of book about, you know, Baudelaire, Sartre, Zola, all this kind of big writer, and pushed me around to go back to school and say, you have to make a movie, you have to make a movie. And if I'm making movie today, I hold him that, because it wasn't a question of choice, not at all.
So let me see if I have this straight. Andrei Petrovsky from the National Film Board of Canada invited you over to his home in the hopes of interesting you in making a movie, and all you could think of was how you're going to rob his house because he was wealthy?
Yeah.
Did you ever take anything from his house?
No, nothing. Nothing. No, well, because...
What changed your mind?
It's just because the first time I get there, people were really, really kind with me, and I lost my aggressivity really, really fast, and he was an unbelievable man. I was yelling after him all the time, shouting about the bourgeoisie, and he never told me that, you know, give me back my key and stuff like that. We did have been a big fight, and he became my spiritual father. My father was staying living at the time, but he was having second grade. He was a labor man, really, really poor man, and never talk with him. And what did happen, it's with the quality of the people that Andrei Petrovsky get me involved with, changed totally my life and, you know, sent me back to university and going back to school.
When you started to break into movies, did you ever behave in any ways that you realized afterwards were totally inappropriate?
I think, you know, when you have this sense of be street smart or you don't lose that. It's funny, you know, I'm making unbelievable money right now, unbelievable money, and it's really hard for me to don't steal a screwdriver once in a while. It's just, it's so funny, interesting feeling too. It's crazy, and I've been talking with some of my teacher that I'm good friend with, you know, and they teach at the bad student and stuff like that, and I told them, I say, you know, I'm making unbelievable money right now with my job as a director and publicity and stuff like that. But it's happened once in a while that I still have that in my blood, and it's something funny.
One last thing. Do you think that your success as a filmmaker now is going to be used as an example of how becoming a filmmaker can reform people?
Not really, because, you know, it's so sequential. I think there's lots of business. I met lots of businessmen who have been passing by the same, you know, same kind of life, and I do live really well. The only thing I want to say in finishing this interview, important for me, it's, you know, when I was writing and was when I was really young, I was the best of my school when I was as a writer, but I'm born in the labor place and the teacher were really bad. And they know that I was a good writer, but nobody did help me at the time to have good grammar. My grammar as a writer is really, really bad. And I think that if each teacher can pick up one student like Petrovsky did, he wasn't a teacher, but work on one student at a time and help somebody else more than what you are supposed to do in your daytime work. And I do believe in some master. I do believe that teacher can seriously help one student. Just pick one per class and help him seriously, and you can have result.
Writer and director Jean-Claude Lauzon. His film Night Zoo opens next Wednesday in New York. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's up?
Well, we have a report on a Republican presidential hopeful, Robert Dole, who, as it turns out today, is not at all hopeful anymore. He basically threw in the towel in a speech before the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He said, "I can read the numbers, and it's a foregone conclusion that George Bush will win the Republican presidential nomination." Also, a report on the Democratic side. First, the Democrats had to win Super Tuesday. Now they have to win over the super delegates. That's 646 Democratic Party honchos who can vote for anyone they please come the convention. And surprisingly, Richard Gebhardt is the front runner with that group.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. ''1988 is the 100th anniversary of the publication of the first Sherlock Holmes book, A Study in Scarlet. To celebrate, the Key Video Company is re-releasing all 14 of the classic Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes films. Ken Tucker has a review.
Sherlock Holmes is certainly one of the most famous of all pop culture creations. Rarely, however, does a character in one medium transfer to another as successfully as Holmes did. The short stories and novellas of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle made Holmes familiar to any literate person in the first half of this century. The film starring Basil Rathbone made Holmes a household name. The first Holmes adaptation, The Hound of the Baskervilles, in 1939, was reasonably faithful to the Arthur Conan Doyle story. The movie was a great popular success, and a new Sherlock Holmes adventure began appearing annually. Sherlock Holmes and the Secret Weapon was made in 1942. World War II was on, and Holmes was updated for the period. He became a brave foe of the Nazis. Holmes' archenemy, Dr. Moriarty, was, of course, all too eager to collaborate with Adolf Hitler. In this scene, Holmes, disguised as a Royal Navy shipman, is tussling with Moriarty, played by Lionel Atwill, to prevent a secret code from falling into enemy hands.
Good evening, Professor Moriarty.
Welcome, Holmes.
I may say I've been expecting you since I made off of your precious Dr. Tobel.
And his code.
Ah, yes. And his code.
Moriarty, this is no simple crime that you contemplate. It's a staggering blow against your own country.
That doesn't concern me overly. I shall make greater profit from this affair than all my other adventures put together.
Then you refuse?
Oh, most assuredly. In fact, I intend to ensure the success of this venture tonight by liquidating you, Mr. Holmes.
A gun? Oh, come now. This is not the Professor Moriarty, the master criminal I once knew. A dock rat could do as much.
Sherlock Holmes and the Secret Weapon was directed by Roy William Neal and was actually based on a Conan Doyle short story, The Dancing Men, but very loosely, as you might imagine. It permitted Basil Rathbone to do more than stride around his drawing room in a silk bathrobe, and these days the movie can be enjoyed as a lively, naive piece of wartime propaganda. Among the other Holmes films being re-released, the standouts are Sherlock Holmes and the Spider-Woman, a campy treat, and The House of Fear, a genuinely suspenseful film based on one of the best of Doyle's stories, The Five Orange Pips. Other new videos include The Living Daylights, the most recent James Bond movie starring Timothy Dalton. Like Sherlock Holmes, James Bond has been impersonated on the screen by a number of actors. Most people agree that, like Basil Rathbone's Holmes, Sean Connery's Bond is the definitive one. Still, Timothy Dalton is a witty, classically trained actor who loosened up enough to give Bond a good shot. There's also Wish You Were Here, the acclaimed comedy drama starring Emily Lloyd as the rebellious daughter of a British shopkeeper during the 1950s.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. I'm going on vacation, and while I'm gone, your host will be Faith Middleton. On the next show, she'll speak with Yehudi Menuhin, one of America's most celebrated violinists. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead will review the new album from English clarinetist Wally Fox and his Soho Shakers. And television critic David Bianculli will review the new HBO documentary, Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam. It combines footage of the war with the voices of actors like Robert De Niro and Sean Penn reading letters the troops wrote home. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show is produced by Amy Sallet, Ed Doherty, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Warren Kozak. Our engineer is Audrey Vlablitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music was composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.